Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for July 27, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two interviews up tonight. First, we'll speak with Joel Shalit, who is the managing editor of Tikkun magazine and author of the book Jerusalem Calling, a memoir of growing up between Israel and America, about what's going on with Israel and its war and its neighbors. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania and a columnist with Progressive Magazine and editor of a collection on Hurricane Katrina forthcoming from Nation Books. And we'll talk to him about race and class, that whole popular set of topics. But before we get to that, some observations on the news, the economic news headlines. First of all, earlier in the week, the Federal Reserve released its so-called Beige Book, which is a collection of briefings from the various districts of the Federal Reserve System. What's going on with the U.S. economy? They have a tremendous intelligence network and produce these reports every 6 weeks just before the policymaking meetings that the Fed's Open Market Committee holds also every 6 weeks. That reporting growth continuing through the United States, economic growth continuing in the United States, but at a slower pace, and this will be a theme of several of these headlines in the coming few minutes. Growth continuing, but it seems to be slowing. Housing markets slowing nearly across the board throughout the United States. Manufacturing sector perversely improving with a couple of regional exceptions, notably our area. But that's the only major sector of the economy that seems to be picking up speed. Auto sales flat to down in most districts. Pricing pressures mixed. Prices of goods rising only modestly in most districts. So inflation does seem to be under control, though some people in the financial markets and the Federal Reserve are a little worried about it. Of most concern to ordinary folks, labor markets remain tight. That is, unemployment rate relatively low by historical standards. Wage pressures were modest, which is how central bankers say no raises forthcoming for most workers. Since they view the world from an employer's point of view, modest wage pressures are good news. If you're trying to pay your bills your wages, that's not such good news. Wage growth continues to be limited, the Federal Reserve observes, to highly skilled occupations such as professional and managerial occupations. So for most workers, stagnant pay packets, but for those at the upper brackets, they're doing very well, a theme of this entire economic expansion, really. In contrast to the 1990s, the upper brackets did very well, but also most other people did too. Not this time. Most other people are going nowhere, and the rich are doing quite well, and corporate profits have been just phenomenal. Most rapid growth in corporate profits, perhaps of any business cycle in modern history, it's not happening with labor income, that's for sure. The Economic Cycles Research Institute, their weekly index of the leading index, which is designed to forecast movements in the U.S. economy 6 to 12 months out. Picked up a little bit last week, but its general trend since the spring has been forecasting a slowdown. So that's still in place. So that also forecasting a slowdown in the U.S. economy, which is not surprising given $75 a barrel oil and continually rising interest rates and the housing market showing signs of falling apart. We'll get to that in a moment. The OECD, the think tank sponsored mostly by the rich industrial countries headquartered in Paris, which produces a monthly leading index for all its major regions of the world. That index rose barely in the month of May. The most recent one available came out earlier this month. I've been away for a while, so I haven't been able to report this, but came out a couple of weeks ago. Interestingly, though, the European economies showing a stronger leading index, a rise in their leading index, forecasting acceleration in their economies, led by Italy, of all things, at the top of the ranks there. The NAFTA economies, though, leading the slowdown, and Japan showing signs of pickup. So after quite a number of years where the U.S. outperformed the other major economic regions of the world, maybe time for a little turnabout there. The Europeans and Japanese may begin a period of outperformance as the U.S. economy slowing down. This morning, the Labor Department reported a decline of 7,000 in first-time claims for jobless insurance. This very sensitive indicator of the job market now still bobbing around in pretty good but not great territory. It took a very dramatic drop in late 2005, early 2006, but it's just been bobbing around in good but not great territory, forecasting the job market is doing okay but not terrific, which is certainly what it has been doing for the last several months. A conference board's count of help wanted ads in newspapers flat in the month of June, following a sharp decline in February, March, April, May. And while this indicator's usefulness has been somewhat clouded by the fact that most job ads are migrating online and away from newspapers, that decline is not a happy portent for future job growth. So it looks like, even though, as I was saying earlier, wage growth is weak despite a pretty low unemployment rate, it looks like the best days of this cycle for the average worker may well be here or past. So this is as good as it gets, folks. The housing market, which has been the driving force of the U.S. economy for the last 3, 4, 5 years, almost all the indicators of that are now pointing downward. National Association of Home Builders, which does a monthly measure of sentiment among contractors, taking a steep dive, now at its lowest level since December 1991, which was quite a recessionary period way back when. So that suggesting a sharp housing slowdown in the coming months. Mortgage applications also weakening in the last couple of weeks. New home sales reported by the Census Bureau the other day slowing even more quickly than anticipated, as the economist at economy.com observed. And we've seen 11% drop in house sales over the last year. And they've also revised downward their estimates for April and May. And the price of the average house also falling for the second consecutive month. So that's pretty unusual behavior. And existing house sales reported by the National Association of Realtors also declining in the month of June rather dramatically, more than people expected. So it does look like the housing bubble is really leaking air seriously now, and we'll see what that all means. But it does look like the major prop to consumer spending is weakening. Let's see. Then the ABC News, Washington Post weekly measure of consumer attitudes fell 2 points last week to an okay range, but not spectacular. The Republicans in the White House and in Congress are always wondering why they're not getting credit for what they think is such a good economy. And the reason is that it's not doing so great for ordinary folks. It's doing great for the country club set and my neighbors here on Wall Street, but it's not doing well for the average worker. So let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Joel Shalit. And that, the song Salvation at the End of the Barrel of a Gun by the Israeli hardcore punk band Dir Yassin. And it seemed appropriate setup for Joel Shalit, who is an expert not only in Israeli politics but punk rock. Welcome to WBAI, Joel.
Hey, it's nice to be with you.
So what's the story of Dir Yassin, the band, not the place, before we get started on the current crisis in Lebanon?
Dir Yassin was a village near Jerusalem that was ethnically cleansed in, I think, 1947 or 1948 by Menachem Begin's terrorist organization, the Stern Gang. couple of hundred civilians, I believe, were killed. And it's legendary in the Arab-Israeli conflict because it is the most paradigmatic example of what critics of ethnic cleansing in Israel's history point out to is when they want to show how Israel was built on the backs and quote unquote and the blood of the Palestinians.
And that band broke up a few years ago. Name quite a provocation, I imagine, to the Israeli broad public.
That's absolutely right. In Israeli terms, to call in an Israeli context, to call yourself Deir Yassin is you know about as confrontational as you can get.
Okay, so speaking of confrontation, what set Israel off? The kidnapping of some soldiers, cross-border action by Hezbollah, unleashed a rain of fury on the Gaza Strip and Lebanon. What was behind this enormous explosion of violence?
Well, it can't be reduced to any simple point or denominator. You know, there were domestic considerations involved. For the first time in Israel's history, you had a government completely led by civilians who were very Amir Peretz, the defense minister, and Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, with no substantial military background at all. Who were very anxious to prove themselves to be as tough on security matters as their predecessors, nearly all of whom have been generals. So that was one factor.
Almost all the prime ministers as well as defense ministers have had military backgrounds?
Yes, very strong military backgrounds. Most recently, I mean, particularly if you look at Rabin, Barak, you know, Sharon, of course, you know, generals. there is a very big fear in Israeli politics of the wimp factor. You know, you have to be somewhat of a military redneck. Like Sharon, he was perfect, you know.
But this is a society where almost everyone does compulsory military service, right?
That's correct. And so having done your military service is a sign of credibility, really, that you've participated in a weird, you know, kind of collectivist ethos in which everybody does their time and sacrifices themselves for several years.
But that's not enough to prove that you're not a wimp.
Not in politics. I mean, Amir Peretz was a captain, you know, but that still wasn't good enough for the Israeli public.
Now, let's talk a bit about him. When he came out of a union background, didn't he? There was a lot of hope that he was going to represent some kind of progressive departure for Israeli politics.
Yeah, and it was well-founded, too. I mean, Amir Peretz probably is the closest thing to a social democrat that's ever graced an Israeli government. And it was, you know, everybody had very good reason to expect that based on his agenda, which was supposed to be the a social democratic agenda, and in many respects a very contemporary left-wing response to the downsizing of welfare states worldwide, Peretz was expected to lead a revolt against that and implement government policies that reflected that once coming into office. And no one expected him to do as well as he did in the Labor Party primary in last November. And a lot of people had grave doubts that he would even be able to lead the Labor Party to second place. Given the Israeli Labor Party's historical ties to big business and to neoliberal capitalist policies.
Yeah, I should point out that a lot of Americans probably think of Israel of kibbutzes and some kind of socialist tradition, but in fact, it's really gone through the neoliberal ringer in the last decade or two. And
it was a process that really started the neoliberal transformation of Israel is something that really began in the late 1960s after the seizure of the occupied territories. And Aaron Kaplan, who is a historian of the Israeli right, argued in an article recently that that's when you can really predate the demise of Israeli labor and social politics. It's right after the Six-Day War and the acquisition of cheap Palestinian labor to fuel the economy.
So let's get back to the proving that they're not wimps. So the Olmert had to prove that he too was not a wimp, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Olmert himself is essentially a technocrat and a party apparatchik. He's been a loyal party guy in the Likud since right after the 1973 war, and security has never been part of his political portfolio or experience. Granted, one would find it hard to argue that that being the mayor of Jerusalem, you would have to learn a lot about security concerns. But by Israeli military standards and the way Israeli voters tend to rank these things, he was nowhere near having acquired the historical experience of someone like Ehud Barak or Ariel Sharon or, you know, any of these people. So, you know, he had a lot to prove. I mean, and the way that you heard a lot of these you know, militant organizations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and in Lebanon, speaking of, Nasrallah put it very well when he said these people are inexperienced, you know. They need to be put through a test. Peretz and Olmert represent the boomer generation finally having asserted its hegemony in Israeli politics. And those are people who have had, to a large degree, a more mixed experience in Israeli civil society than the generations of generals that led the country prior to them. They're yuppies to a certain extent.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, who is the managing editor of Tikkun magazine and author of the book Jerusalem Calling, a memoir of growing up between Israel and America. So were you surprised by the fury of this reaction to what were undeniably provocations?
Yes and no. No, insofar as the IDF's response to the Kerem Shalom attack, near the Gaza border in late June was outrageously severe and unnecessary when they reentered Gaza nearly a year after having left. Based on their response to that Palestinian action, in which, you know, for your listeners to remind them, Gilad Shalit was captured as a POW, it seemed pretty likely that the government would order a similar response to the capture of two Israeli POWs on the Lebanese border. What you saw for the very first time was this government's security profile developing. So the answer, again, is no, I wasn't surprised on that basis. But what has been surprising is the extent and the length of Israel's response and its strategic depth in Lebanon. That's been the most surprising thing, and what a lot of journalists and political analysts have been trying to figure out is why they have gone about launching an all-out war on this basis. What the stakes were, what was to be gained, or was it simply just an exercise in what many on the left call typically genocidal or brutal Israeli responses to Arab terrorism, quote unquote. You know.
Well, what's your favorite explanation then?
My favorite explanation is a little more nuanced than that. I think the government wanted to strike a deterrent example for sure because of domestic political considerations. I think that cannot be discounted. I think that the Israeli army, twice has been humiliated by increasingly savvy and skilled Palestinian and Lebanese guerrilla fighters, and they've learned well, and they're doing, you know, if you look at it purely in military terms, their skill set's improving rapidly, and they're showing a lot of determination. But I also think that the Israeli military and political establishment has been extremely concerned about there being an Iranian hidden hand in this event. That was part of what many Middle Eastern governments, Sunni Middle Eastern governments, have been ascertaining as being a growing an attempt to create a Shiite crescent, as Jordan's King Abdullah put it, in the Middle East, as part of Iran's attempt to act as a counter-hegemonic regional force to the United States. And I think that the Israelis, in a way, their actions can be very well read as a response to that. And ironically, given if you look at the degree to which the Americans have encouraged the Israelis to respond in the manner that they have, it can be argued that the Israelis are also trying to restore American deterrence in the region as their primary regional ally, you know? So I don't think that that's unreasonable.
At the moment, it looks like Israel's actions in Lebanon are promoting unity between Shiites and Sunnis, who seem to both be cheering on Hezbollah's fairly successful resistance.
Well, that's absolutely correct. It's been completely irrational, you know, and it just goes to show how absolutely unimaginative and unlearned both the political and military elites in Israel are regarding what kind of resistance and what kind of alliances form around their military actions. It was stupid, and it remains stupid. And unfortunately, what the Israelis now have, they put themselves in the position of having to really fight a war to the death in order to rescue their, their damaged deterrence and their damaged sense of invincibility. I mean, they are, for all of the damage that the IDF is doing in Lebanon, they are taking a serious licking. And I don't think that...
And much worse than they expected, it seems.
The disaster that is unfolding for the Israeli military in Lebanon right now is every bit as bad as what happened to the Israeli military in the first few days of the Yom Kippur War. And it will be assessed as such when this war is over. You know, the military leadership and the political leadership have failed to provide the country and the army in particular with the kind of leadership required to prosecute such an operation successfully, irrespective of what kind of moral evaluations you can place on the decision of having gone to war in this manner.
Now, I was looking at the right-wing, kind of semi-shady-looking website the other day, Debka, which they seem to or claim to or would like you to believe that they have sources in intelligence or represent Mossad or something, but who knows what's really going on. But anyway, the analyst there was arguing that this is a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran, and they're using pawns to fight the war for them, that the U.S. is perfectly willing to fight to the last Israeli, and Iran is perfectly willing to fight to the last Hezbollah fighter. But that's what's behind this current action. What do you think of that?
Unfortunately, these kinds of right-wing, or as you can call them, particularly when they're not attached to nationalist causes in Israel, security conservative arguments are absolutely correct. There is no way to not look at it that way, particularly if you're looking at it from a progressive point of view and have a very strong understanding of the historical use of proxy states by the United States to achieve its, results abroad. I believe that to be the case, and I think that it's time for anybody who cares at all about Israel, whether you're on the left or on the right, to start to reconsider Israel's dependence on the United States and subservience to American foreign policy. Israel needs to become a part of the Middle East. It needs to now more than ever, and with every cluster bomb being dropped on, a milk factory outside Beirut, they move further and further away from that.
What you just said kind of reverses the usual line you hear from critics of the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby, who say that that Congress is Israeli occupied territory and that foreign interests have captured U.S. foreign policy and causing the United States to support Israel against our own interests. You're saying pretty much the opposite. What do you think of that line that is so popular, like in Counterpunch and in other places?
I think it has some merit insofar as it does point out that there is an inordinate amount of attention placed on Israel and financing given to Israel. For its military and to a lesser extent economic endeavors. But notice they never mention anything about the economic side of things in any other terms other than the settlements, right? At the same time, I think that what these arguments always miss, and it does beg the question of anti-Semitism, even when these kinds of analyses and arguments are offered by Jews, even like Stephen Blank, what is it, Jeffrey Blankfort, that's the guy's name, that the United States has reasons for investing in Israel and for propping up Israel that have nothing to do with anyone's interests but those of America itself, and that the Americans have done so over the years because of the increasing importance that the Middle East has occupied in overall American strategic policy.
And is this policy?
In that sense, I agree with Noam Chomsky more than I do with, like, Walton Mearsheimer, I think he's absolutely on the ball about that.
Is this policy success? I mean, we've managed to alienate everyone in the region. Everyone hates us. The war in Iraq is a total disaster. The U.S. is not doing well there. Now, Israel not doing well, and it's the Lebanese people are suffering enormously. But the Israeli military not accomplishing its goals. Is this policy make any sense in the long run?
It's a completely irrational failure on every level, and clearly the Americans are unable to find any way to actualize their own political goals in the Middle East. And at this point, they're doing no good for the Israelis, and the Israelis are most importantly doing no good for themselves by conflating their interests with those of the United States.
And then finally, we've seen the slogan in some anti-war demonstrations, where this was popped up in London a few days ago, "We're all Hezbollah." There's a certain degree of identification with Hezbollah it is successfully doing some damage to the Israeli military, which not too many other people have been able to do, but... what do you think of that kind of identification?
I think it's childish. I think that that's by identifying with a reactionary political formation involved in a nihilistic conflict in which none of the parties involved are worth supporting. You end up obscuring the plight and of the victims in the conflict, which are, in Lebanon's case, the Lebanese civilian population, and in Israel are the Israeli civilian population. They are the real victims of this conflict. They are being, led to the brink by political formations in both their countries, which no one on the progressive side of the equation in the West should get behind or back or rationalize in any kind of legitimate way. Hezbollah are theocrats, and there is no reason from a social justice perspective to back their struggle because they have an ideology of state which is antithetical to anything that the left represents or desires in the West. It is simply a childish response to back Hezbollah on that level.
All right, thank you. Thanks for joining us, Joel Shalit. Joel is the author of the book Jerusalem Calling, published by Akashic Books, came out several years ago, and the managing editor of Tikkun magazine, based in Berkeley. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And let's take a break for station identification, and we'll be back with part two.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on the FM dial and on the web at WBAI.org. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's take a little musical break while we get Adolf Reed up on the phone.
Right.
And that was the first, 57 seconds of Guilty of Being White by the 1980s hardcore band Minor Threat. Now we're joined on the line by Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and a columnist for the Progressive magazine and also editor of a collection about Hurricane Katrina coming out from, is it Nation Books, Adolf?
It's coming out from Nation, although I didn't edit it. I just wrote the intro. I think the editor is my namesake, Betsy Reed.
Ah, okay. I'm sorry about that. Apologies to Betsy too, this is a good way to talk about race and class. The standard analysis. You've written an introduction to the book. You've got a contribution to it. You've got a bit about this in your forthcoming Progressive column. A lot of people on the left interpreted the disaster of Hurricane Katrina as almost mostly a racial issue, it was about. America's neglect of black people. And is that your view, or is it a little more complicated than that?
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, I think, yeah, that's certainly the way that leftist or people who identify with the left standardly interpreted the asymmetrical outcome, I guess, of Katrina. But, you know, I was just reading this morning, Joe Fagan and Kristen Lavelle's piece in the Monthly Review on race and Hurricane Katrina, and what I noticed was that at all the key points where there are verbs that imply action and will and consciousness, in this discourse, the nouns are all reifications, and it's interesting because in the formulation, the way you just laid it out, I think that's indicative, right? America has neglected black people. Well, who is America actually, right? And what does it mean to neglect? And I think the limitation of a racial discourse is, or one big limitation of the racial discourse is that it does depend on just that kind of reification.
Well, what could you elaborate on that?
Well, sure. I mean, take the Katrina case, for instance. It was obvious and conspicuous that the people who were screwed over worst in the city, anyway, were disproportionately black. Right? They were also disproportionately poor. And yes, it's a no accident that the poor people in New Orleans were disproportionately black, or that the black people in New Orleans were disproportionately poor.
And that just doesn't apply to New Orleans. That's true of the entire nation.
Sure. And it's a twice told, a gazillionth times told tale about why that's the case, the legacy of the slavery and all the rest of it. The thing is, though, what, and this is the question I keep asking, and I haven't really gotten an answer yet, what does defining this as being fundamentally about racism help us, how does that definition help us to understand the actual mechanisms that produce and reproduce this kind of inequality on a daily basis? And how does that analysis or diagnosis help us figure out any ways to try to combat inequality or overcome inequality, challenge it? And I just don't think the racial analysis does. I mean, the racial analysis doesn't lead you any place other than to say we need to denounce racism, that makes a lot of people feel good to hear, right? Just like saying the Pledge of Allegiance can make people who have a different ideological commitment feel good, but it does, or doing the Stations of the Cross for a Catholic, but it doesn't have any impact. It doesn't lead to any sort of strategic discussion that could actually have an impact on making people's lives better.
Well, the song I opened this segment with, Guilty of Being White by Minor Threat, I'm sure people couldn't hear the lyrics very well, but I looked them up this afternoon and discovered that it was kind of thing you hear often from white folks. I'm not responsible for slavery. I wasn't around. I didn't lynch anybody because I wasn't around. So what am I guilty of? Now, that is true to a certain extent, but also it tries to evade the fact that being born white in America makes your life a lot easier, and being born black in America makes your life a lot tougher. So how can we avoid this racialization of everything without then facing race as a problem at all?
Well, I mean, I think that one way to do it, or one way we've been trying to do it anyway, is to start from the concrete, right? You know, to start from people's everyday conditions and concerns, and build out from that, right? I mean, why were people left on overpasses and the convention center and the Superdome were to drown like rats in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans? You can't say that they weren't factored into the evacuation plans because of the racist mayor and racist local government, unless you want to twist what we typically think of racism as meaning, because the mayor is black and a majority of the city council are black. You know, the mayor determined 2 months before the hurricane, when they were doing evacuation planning, that the city ostensibly couldn't afford to secure buses to provide for the evacuation of the 100,000 or so people who couldn't afford to get out on their own. So what the Nagin administration did was produce a DVD to distribute in the lower Ninth Ward to tell people, you better go for what you know. And I suppose, in fact, I know, I can imagine it, I can hear the analysis that those people were in the position to be chumped and cast aside like that because they're relatively devalued because they're black and poor, and they're poor because they're black. Well, in some abstract, ultimate way, I suppose that could be true. In fact, I'd grant that is true. That doesn't help us understand how they got stuck in the first place. That doesn't help us understand how the black-led government made a cost-benefit calculation that ultimately privileged, although I don't like to use that as a verb, I apologize, but that ultimately privileged setting money in the municipal budget aside for support of upscale housing development or other business subsidies or tax and fees relief to being prepared to evacuate the poorest of the citizens in one of the most hurricane-prone cities in the country. And I've been saying the same thing over and over again, so I guess I apologize if I sound kind of peevish about it. But calling it racism doesn't get us anywhere, right? It just doesn't help us do anything. You know, it doesn't help us figure out how to challenge it. It doesn't help us make sense. It doesn't help us see how the processes of redirection or discrediting public action and of the capacities of public authority in New Orleans are embedded in a much larger neoliberal assault on the notion of the public good. You know, it just doesn't get us anywhere.
All right, well, take us in a more productive direction then.
Okay, well, to start out, in the case of New Orleans, right, it's pretty clear. I mean, I think that the key, the real key to making sense of who got screwed and who is most likely going to be screwed in the future in New Orleans is to focus on property ownership and the rights and privileges that are conferred on property owners. And of course, the bigger the property, the bigger the rights, as it were, and the smaller the property, the more precarious the purchase of even property small property owners is on a public voice. And I mean, that's something that we can see pretty clearly in the struggle over reconstruction of New Orleans now. Renters have been dealt out of the equation entirely. And that's one of the insidious ways that the race discourse actually worked, right? Understandably, since by October in national media and certainly much more commonly on the local front, you could hear white people saying that the city needed to be rebuilt on a smaller footprint and as a whiter city. Some some local bourgeois even invoked Charleston, South Carolina, as a model. And Charleston is a big black population. It's just not a majority, and it's like not politically empowered. But so in that context, when Mayor Nagin seemed to be nodding acquiescing, maybe too enthusiastically, in the schemes that that Joe Canizaro and the other big developers had for rebuilding the city, naturally enough, a populist reaction came in the form of questioning whether the mayor was going to go along with not letting black people come back to the city, or with destroying the black majority, or with getting rid of the black majority in New Orleans. So Nagin backs up, and that's where, ironically, his, the Chocolate City comment that made him so notorious for a few minutes came from, as an effort to reassure black New Orleanians that he wasn't going to sell them out, basically. But what happened was, in a deft move, race came to substitute for property ownership, and the rights of property owners got read into the equation, and that's the way that to this point anyway, the public discussion around reconstruction of the city has been democratized, at least superficially. Now, I realize that I'm talking around the question. I mean, in the case of New Orleans, as I said, I mean, I think that the key to making sense of what happened to whom is, calls us to examine political economy, right, and the class forces that are operating on both a large scale and a small scale in the city. Generally, and I could say, we can talk some more about that in more detail if you want. More generally, I'd say that that a more productive direction, again, is for us to try. We need to build a movement, right? There's no movement for progressive social change. There's no movement for there's no organized political force in this country now that even tries to push the envelope in the direction of social wage and social democratic policy orientations. And I think that what we've got to do is to start trying to find ways to try to build such a movement from the ground up. And I think the only way to do that is to connect with people around the broadly shared concerns that most of the population have. And these have to do with issues like health care, education, jobs, wages, employment security. And that doesn't mean, I hear this again and again. I hear this charge again and again and again. That doesn't mean not paying attention to racism. That doesn't mean not paying attention to racial inequality. But what it does mean is trying to start from a point of view or from a frame of reference politically that unites people around shared concerns. And then I think you can. In the process of building solidarities around those broadly shared concerns, you can, that puts you in a better position to attack racial prejudice and bigotries of other forms. By contrast, when people start talking about, stuff like institutional racism or systemic racism, they're by and large talking about abstractions that.
These are agentless forces. That
right, exactly.
Who do you talk with?
Right, exactly.
To change this, I'm speaking with Adolph Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, a progressive magazine columnist, and contributor to a forthcoming Nation Books collection on Hurricane Katrina. And I should point out that you're not a distant observer. You've got a long history in New Orleans and growing up in segregated New Orleans, right?
Yeah, that's right, and I guess it's I mentioned something about that in my forthcoming progressive column. David Roediger has attacked me for being insensitive to or being inattentive to the realities of racism in New Orleans, and Manning Marable has done the same thing, and it just almost tickles me. I went to segregated schools in New Orleans, rode segregated buses when the first time I saw the Battle of Algiers, I was riveted to the screen because the opening scenes were just so much like our relationships with the NOPD in those years. I mean, the police weren't occupying our army. We had no rights that any white person was bound to respect. And the point in mentioning that isn't to say that, you know, that was real racism and what we experience today somehow isn't. Rather, it's a yes. I mean, inequality in New Orleans has been, you know, the dynamics through which inequality has been reproduced, and through which class power is reproduced in New Orleans have been partly racialized, right, since 1718 when the city was founded. They've been partly gendered in the same way. But you know, that saying that doesn't, you know, acknowledging that those dynamics, that race is a metric through which class forces operate, isn't to say that race doesn't exist, or rather racism doesn't exist, or that there's no such thing as racial injustice, or that you can't find racism or can't find racist attitudes among white people in the city or any place else. I mean, I think another problem with the racism notion, by the way, is that it just means too many things, right? Racism can refer to structured social relations. Racism can refer to a sort of ostensibly blind patterns of institutional operation. It can refer to bad attitudes and bigotry. It can, you know, refer to some forms of false consciousness. It can, you know, refer to a black investment banker not being able to get a cab, or a white colleague not recognizing you in the street. It can refer to the sentencing differential for crack and powder cocaine, and police brutality, and all those things are injustices. I don't mean to trivialize any one of them, but the problem is that to lump them all conveniently under the abstract rubric of racism doesn't really help us understand any one of them.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of times David Roediger's attack on you in Monthly Review for makes you sound like some white writer for the American Prospect who wants to put race behind us, which is a very unjust accusation.
Right.
But in any case, you have been critical of the whiteness studies area, which is David Roediger is one of the founders of and leading practitioner of. And, you know, speaking as someone of Irish-Italian origin, it was very interesting for me to learn how to historicize the emergence of this idea of being white. What is your beef with this whiteness studies game?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, that the initial insight or the fundamental insight, well, the fundamental point of The Wages of Whiteness, just like Alexander Saxon's work, is insightful and it's useful, and I think that it had the effect, like the effect that you note, on a lot of people, right? And it's a good effect. I think the problem, you know, because that early work encouraged people to encouraged all of us to think about whiteness as an ideological construct that emerged over time, right? I think the problem has as much as anything else to do with the pathologies of academic life. I mean, there's a powerful tendency for a clever insight and a useful insight to get blown up into a subfield, and it's kind of the equivalent for the poker players in the audience of, you know, seeing the 25-cent bet on the table and raising it $100,000. I mean, what's happened is that in the field of whiteness studies, the notion of whiteness itself has become ontologized, right? So the same kind of abstract rhetoric or abstract discourse that Herbert Butterfield cautioned two-thirds of a century ago is problematic because it depends on concepts that are incapable of concrete visualization, tends to propel whiteness studies. So there's a discourse of populations seeking whiteness or approaching whiteness or attaining whiteness. And, of course, those aren't really credible accounts of what any human beings or what large groups of human beings actually do or have done. They also don't problematize what whiteness is and how whiteness itself has evolved, how its meanings, boundaries, and significance have evolved over time. I guess that's my principal beef with the whiteness study, or those are my principal beefs with the whiteness study stuff.
Let's just close on a different note. You spoke several times about having some kind of positive agenda with a material appeal to a broad section of the population. You've been heavily involved in trying to organize the Labor Party in the United States. Give us a report. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but give us a report on what you've been up to.
Well, the biggest thing is we decided to take the electoral plunge, and we have been pursuing a ballot line in South Carolina. And
why South Carolina?
Well, because the Democratic Party there is probably the most worthless in the nation, and people understand that they don't get anything from the Democrats at all down there. But also because the South Carolina State AFL-CIO is a Labor Party affiliate and has been for a number of years. We've got a good base in the Charleston Longshore Unions and in some other unions in the Charleston area. Our campaign for free public higher education has gotten some traction on public campuses down there. So we've actually been organizing in South Carolina for several years. The idea came up about a year ago, and we talked to the local folks down there and started getting enthusiastic about it. The more people we talked to, the more enthusiastic they got. And the bottom line is, a couple weeks ago, we submitted 16,500 signatures to the State Election Commission. We need to have 10,000 valid signatures of voters in the state to be qualified as a political party, and we're going to have a founding meeting in September. And people who are interested and want to get involved, and especially to give us some support for building the South Carolina Labor Party, should go to our website, www.thelaborparty.org.
And anything happening elsewhere in the country, or has South Carolina been focus of the efforts?
South Carolina is where we've concentrated the electoral stuff. I mean, we've also been taking the free higher education campaign around, and that's been adopted now by the American Association of University Professors, the American Federation of Teachers, and several big faculty unions around the country, including the PSC CUNY. And we're planning for the fall to try to roll out that national organizing around the free higher education idea also. But at this point, South Carolina is the focal point of our electoral activity, and I got to say, I'm really excited about it. I've been spending a lot of time down there since November, and our activists in South Carolina are pretty excited about it. We've been working flea markets all over the state because those are working class shopping centers in South Carolina, and the reaction that we've gotten from folks on the ground has been really positive and enthusiastic. A lot of it's about time that somebody starts trying to speak for working people. And frankly, I found myself often down at those flea markets feeling reminded of just why it was that the planter class was so obsessively fearful of the possibilities for a political alliance between black freed people and the bottom third or so of the white population after the Civil War, because the basis is pretty much there. And I think, big point is, from our point of view, is that I feel confident that we can build it in South Carolina, and given what South Carolina is supposed to be, given that the AFL-CIO has written it off, the AFL-CIO in either flavor, and that the Democrats have written off the state, I think we're in a good position to show what direct appeal to working people on the basis of their common class interests can actually do. And if we can do it in South Carolina, then it should be pretty clear we can do it any place in America.
Well, thank you. Good luck, Adolf. And thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, columnist of the Progressive magazine and contributor to a forthcoming book of essays on Hurricane Katrina coming from Nation Books, and a tireless organizer for the Labor Party as well. And again, that website, thelaborparty.org, pay it a visit and do us all some good. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this from The Long Blondes.